was sort of right before I came to Beijing, actually, that I was sort of revisiting. Maybe it was right before I went to Europe this summer. I was sort of revisiting my own research project as a whole, and sort of came to this understanding of it as four complementary concepts in a sort of Venn diagram, paired concepts, where there would be a panoptic surveillance paired with a panhaptic touch sense of computer networks, as means of tracking bodies through both closed and open spaces, or striated and smooth spaces, respectively. And then the other pair had to do with simulation in terms of the data generated from those databases and networks then being used as statistically generated predictive models of human behavior, and those being controlling tools, whether through finance or economics, business, human behavior, crime, shopping, consumption, you name it. That being paired with then spectacle, which is sort of, the gloss that ties it all together and makes us forget that all this stuff is actually going on behind the scenes. The production of social relations in a positive sense. And then all of these four concepts being united by the central theme of control. And really, this is what we're describing as the control society. And so, you ask the question of, have I seen evidence of any of this while I've been here? And I think with the Olympics, it's been quite interesting, being in China, seeing the paired concepts, particularly of surveillance and spectacle, at work here, in the sense of this, huge proliferation of cameras all over the place, which I won't make the conclusion as being particular to Beijing, because certainly there are lots of other large cities around the world also mushrooming with surveillance cameras, or particular to an Olympics, because certainly that has a lot to do with this proliferation of cameras. But to take that sort of automated visioning technology and add to that a more traditional Chinese form of surveillance with so many different people in uniform, and there are almost more types of uniforms and more different types of officials than you can imagine. And from sort of official soldiers guarding military machinery on the Olympic Green to old women in the Hutong wearing a red band around their arm, keeping a neighborhood watch. And 50 paces down the street, there's another one. And 50 paces down the street, there's another one. And that's a whole different form of surveillance that my experiences in the West have no parallel to. On the other hand, you've got the spectacle of the Olympics, the spectacle of Fuwa, and the spectacle of One World, One Dream, and the spectacle of all the bright colors, and the spectacle of all the new facilities. But beyond that, the spectacle of a new Beijing, and new subway lines, and new buildings, and my local friends here telling me that, oh my God, that didn't exist a month ago, and that, that's completely different than it was last year. And oh my God, that building is completely decaying, but they put up this big banner over it so that nobody could see it. And that, I've really seen those twin concepts of surveillance and spectacle on full display here, and it really gives you a really embodied sense of how powerful that can be. Like, extremely, extremely, extremely powerful. I would say that 95% of the people that come through here as part of the games will not give a second thought to surveillance and spectacle while they're here, except for the fact that they were told by the media at home before they left, oh, China is an oppressive society that has a lot of surveillance and you know, restricts freedoms. And so they'll come, they'll make a cursory note of a surveillance camera, and they'll go on being a channeled object of information through the conduits of Beijing and Olympic society. And I find that highly interesting, but also highly frightening in the sense of how powerful those kind of paired concepts can be. Uh-huh. Does that give ideas for resistance at this time? No. Still working on it.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you said it already, this question of surveillance and the extremely networked surveillance that we're seeing here is definitely not something particular to Beijing or China. The way it's interconnected at so many different levels may be sort of very interesting to a foreign eye, but it happens all the same in the West in terms of every time you pull out your credit card or, you know, all of these, everything is, mm-hmm. is tracked, right?
Which is what I referred to as panopticism earlier.
Uh-huh.
So that, I want to keep that distinct from surveillance because I think they're two different modalities of control.
Uh-huh.
So while I agree with you, it's important to me to keep those distinct.
Okay. How do you, can you make a more... can you explain a little bit what you mean then by panhaptic?
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is borrowing, of course, from Foucault and then taken up by Deleuze and Guattari. And it has to do with the ideas of striated and smooth space.
Okay.
And a striated space is very much an enclosed grid-like space, what Foucault would consider sort of a traditional disciplinary space,
mm-hmm.
partitioned, segmented, but also surveyed in a remote sense by some watching figure.
Right.
Whether that is the prison guard in the tower in the panopticon, or whether it's the factory foreman on the shop floor,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's the teacher surveying the students,
mm-hmm.
all in their partitioned desks, or, you know, whether it's the hospital warden watching the madmen in the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
Etc. But panopticism implies in this case a very remote optic vision. And so there's a separation between the objects being observed and that subject who does the observing. With smooth space, on the other hand, it's more of an open, flowing space that circumvents, probably be the best word, the striations of the grid.
Mm-hmm.
It's permeable in terms of enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're talking really about a space of open flows. Open flows, in my reading, present a particular challenge to a fixed optical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The fixed optical perspective can't keep up with the movements of flow. And so, therefore, instead of being in one fixed optical position and trying to capture flows, which is impossible, you can only capture a snippet of a flow, you need to essentially ride the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And riding the flow is not remote. It's very haptic, sensuous, tactile. You know, as the flow moves, you move with it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, for me, computer networks, with their various touch points, whether those touch points are ATMs, or whether those, you know, if it's swiping your Visa at a restaurant, or if it's taking money out from a bank machine, or if you've got a radio frequency chip on your car as you go through a toll bridge, or, you know, in sports, if you've got a chip on your running shoe as you're running the marathon, or a GPS device in your golf cart as you're kind of driving through the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are all to me, very much more smooth, sensuous, understandings of the body as it moves in open space. Mm-hmm. And so that, when I talk about panopticism, I'm sort of juxtaposing that or contrasting it to panopticism, mm-hmm. as something that is non-fixed and optical, non-Euclidean in that sense. Mm-hmm. And it's more of a permeable, flowing concept.
What's interesting there, then, I would say is, I mean, if you want to talk about the way that the Chinese government has and does try to run its bureaucracy, and the funny thing, you'll hear the biggest sort of, I don't know if it's an excuse or a reason given by almost everyone by the way things are here, is it has to be this way because the population of China is just too big. You cannot control it. It's impossible to have a panopticon with this kind of population, right? So by employing everyone from the security guy in front of the embassy to the military guy guarding the Olympic Green to the old lady, you know, sitting on the street, you have sort of managed to tap into the network at all of these different nodes and different hierarchies, use the people, each from their own level and from their own sort of line of sight, in order to create a very flowed way of controlling a very wild and chaotic idea of what China is, you know, mm-hmm. what I'm saying. And this goes back to the thing about, I mean, and this happens at so many, this is why the Chinese government is broken down into so many governmental bureaus. There's a difference between the national government versus provincial bureaus and all of these different divisions of the hierarchy. And I always wonder then how that relates to what we're seeing also as a simultaneous, like, breaks in these nodes, right? When you see the fact that there's all this protocol, but it's broken at so many points in the system, mm-hmm. you know? There's so many uniforms, yes, but a lot of those uniforms can be put on by anybody, right? And anybody can choose to sort of, people find so many different ways on individual levels to sort of maneuver through that system.
Well, I think that's, you know, some interesting observations that you've made, not just now, but over the past few months, that have really, you know, resonated with me in that sense. Panopticism works because it's in an enclosed space, mm-hmm. and because you can create boundaries, and because you can partition subjects, and because spatially it's manageable.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
The flows are manageable.
Exactly.
Okay? When all of a sudden you broaden, so, you know, I've done some work, some earlier work that suggests that, you know, there are two main stresses on this sort of disciplinary system. And one is the idea of spatial scalability. You know, as the space itself becomes increasingly large, it totally disrupts the ability of a fixed optical perspective to manage that space. The other one, though, is the idea of temporality and speed. And as flows move faster, it also puts a stress on the system that challenges a fixed optical perspective to handle that system. And so the carceral logic of the disciplinary space becomes challenged at every turn. If you speed up the flow or if you broaden the spatial parameters. And I think when we're talking about the massive population here, in some ways it's almost like talking about speeding up a flow.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
You know, whether you're talking
also
about
expansion of space.
Yeah, I mean, to a degree, China is going to be China. I mean, those nation-state boundaries are fixed. Beijing probably has some urban sprawl left in it if it wants to.
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Yeah, you know. But more or less, in terms of spatial scalability, things are pretty fixed. Now, that said, what's fixed is pretty big. Those are big spaces. But what you're doing is you're increasing the speed of a flow. And by going from a population of 500 million not so long ago to a population of 1.3 billion today, what you've really done is sped up a flow. And even though if it's still within the same spatial parameters, you've challenged that disciplinary system by speeding up the flow. This is where the system becomes more permeable and it bleeds and there are gaps and there's noise and there's inefficiency. Mm-hmm. But as you point out, and I think quite clearly and very interestingly, that opens up new spaces for people to navigate and move within. And you know, so for coming back to Blues and Guattari, when you are talking about your process of getting a visa to stay in China, you're talking about finding smooth spaces within a very structured, rigid, sedimented hierarchy of bureaucracy, what they would consider a striated structure.
Yes.
And so when the stresses on striation become, you know, too great to bear, cracks open, you know? And those cracks are very interesting smooth spaces through which the intelligent nomad can navigate.
That leaves us a lot of space.
Now, as I'm learning about China, of course, is that there are a lot of spaces that can be navigated.
Yeah.
So the question is, why don't more people navigate them? That, to me, is the interesting question.
Well, you have to get to the point of begging that question in the first place. I think that people do. It depends on whether you're aiming big or aiming small. No?
Well, I mean, depends.
People can navigate, you know, sort of loopholes in the system on a very small level every day if it comes down to, like, you know, cheating their water bill somehow to somebody trying to do something a little bit more revolutionary.
Well, and I guess that's the other question, is that I think there's a sense in the West that by necessity there is a desire for revolution.
Hmm.
And I'm not so sure there is. Is there a desire for change? Perhaps. Probably. But I think change is a lot more micro scale than revolution. Revolution's a loaded concept.
Right.
And I'm not so sure. Again, this is obviously coming from very limited experience, but, you know, the more I learn, the more I sense that the perceptions that people have at home of what should be happening here are never going to come to fruition. You know? There's never going to be a modernization in the same way that it's been experienced already in the West.
Right.
There's never going to be a revolution in the sense of certain questions of public and private, or certain questions of politics. Because I get the sense that in a lot of ways, people like the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know? This very, very unique and unseen in the history of the world blend of sort of communist politics and opening capitalist markets. It's very dramatic, but I don't know if I get this revolutionary sense in the air. And so I think that's quite significant in that those in the West are getting this mediatized perception that, okay, well, the influx of capital and consumption and Western style beliefs through that vehicle is going to change China for the better. And I'm thinking more along the lines of, I think China's pretty comfortable where it is right now. I don't know if there will be a change for your better. There might be a change for its own better. There might be changes for China's own better, but I don't think they'll necessarily follow the Western model of progress.
For sure.
And yeah, it might sound very simple to say that, but I don't think that's such a very simple concept back home. I think there, to a large degree, it's, oh, well, that's great. You know, the backward Chinese will
catch up.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, they got a lot of shit figured out. They've got a lot of shit figured out. They've been doing civilization a lot longer than you have. And I guess that's my best way of putting it, you know. They've got 5,000 years of doing civilization. Your country's existed for a few hundred, so fuck off.